Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. With meaningful diplomacy on the back burner, the Europeans have shifted their Ukraine project narrative to accusations that Russia is violating NATO airspace. It would seem they will do whatever it takes to start World War III. Also, obliteration and ethnic cleansing of Gaza begins, in earnest, with U.S. support. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark. You know, when I was putting this program together, I titled it, as you guys both know, Europe's War Lust. But in between time, I was thinking maybe the title should be From Article 4 to Article 5. Do you get my drift?
So what you're talking about is there is an obvious intention to cry wolf, right? This is a story of Peter crying wolf in an attempt to escalate tensions with Russia to draw the U.S. Back into the conflict to the extent that Europeans believe the Trump administration should be involved, which they feel it is not. Article 4 is a requirement for consultations on a security issue. What it essentially is the Baltic nations are really upset that Russia exists and have called together a group therapy session for the rest of NATO to come together and, you know, commiserate that they too are unhappy that Russia exists. The incident is being done over Russia transiting a small number of MiG-31s through the slim international airspace over the Baltic Sea to the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad, something that is done on a routine basis. But the Europeans are unhappy that the Trump administration did not act outrage enough about this alleged Russian styrofoam and wooden decoy drones that so threatened Poland. But they're also upset that the Trump administration has announced the end of various degrees of military support and training for countries on the front line with Russia, particularly the Baltics. So Article 5, of course, it says that NATO countries should do something. It actually is not an immediate call to war.
Yeah, it's grossly misunderstood, yeah. Article 5. And most people know that didn't even know that Article 4 existed. And they completely ignore Article 1, like not cause trouble with your neighbors, which NATO has been doing endlessly here. You know, George, you know, we've all been following kind of the narrative changes. And I'm not going to go through all of them right here because there's been so many of them, but we had security guarantee. That was like for about 10 days, 2 weeks. That was their mantra. And then, as Mark pointed out, these drones, even the Polish prime minister had to point out that the only damage done was to a house, and it was, well, the Poles did it themselves, not the Russians. And now we go to incursions into NATO airspace, which, if you take a close look at it or make it to the eighth or ninth paragraph, it's not what it appears to be. The headline is deceptive here. So we have these, you know, rolling narrative changes here, and it's kind of like to see what will, you know, catch Trump's attention. And it doesn't seem the Trump administration is too disturbed by all this for reasons that Mark just explained to us. But that means they're going kind of up the narrative escalation ladder, if you know what I mean. And it's more and more threatening. It's different from security guarantees, plywood and styrofoam. That's not so damn. Oh, but a MiG, now that's serious business. So this is its own kind of logic of escalation.
No, I think that's right. And I think that you're absolutely right that by bringing up, well, it's no longer drones, it's a MiG, three MiG aircraft that cross Estonian airspace. And I think the Estonians even said, the planes were flying over Tallinn. So they're actually right over Tallinn. So maybe that will get
Well, I mean, George, why didn't they send up aircraft to intercept them? Oh, well, they don't have any.
That's right. But of course, we had the Lithuanian defense minister saying, yeah, I think we should absolutely start shooting down Russian aircraft.
I mean, who would be doing the shooting down?
Well, that's a very good question. Who would be shooting down? Obviously, it's the United States. And that is really the gravamen of all of this overwrought talk about, you know, the Russian incursions of NATO airspace, because there's also Romania. That's also in the mix. So somehow one drone flew over Romanian airspace, I don't know, for 30 minutes or whatever. So all of that is part of this overheated rhetoric. And Ursula von der Leyen, when she announced the other day the 19th sanctions package against Russia, specifically brought up, well, things are getting really worse and worse. Russia is getting more and more aggressive. Look at how it's incursing into NATO airspace. So this is all undoubtedly a part of trying to get Trump on board, and Keir Starmer did the same. I mean, when they were during the meeting in Chequers last week, he absolutely said, no, we have to get tough with Russia. We got to get tough. That's the only way we can ever get anywhere with Russia. And that's what they're hoping to do. And Trump, by being so ambiguous and by somehow, you know, making, you know, one kind of statement one day, another kind another day, kicking the can down the road, is encouraging all of this because it's giving the Europeans yes. hope that at some point he's going to finally come down and take a side and do whatever he needs to do against Russia.
But that's from a European perspective, I can understand that. But Mark, indecision is indecision. I'm not going to decide. I mean, Trump is essentially going to let this play out on the battlefield, Mark.
I don't know that that's necessarily true. That's okay. Apparently what the Trump administration is doing for the moment. Although in the last week, they did announce that the first package of Trump administration arms from the U.S. Will be sent to Ukraine, although this is supposedly paid by NATO or by the European members of NATO or whatever. Not a particularly large package as such things go, 500 million, but, you know, you could certainly regard that as part of a military escalation. Certainly the Russians some Russians will be killed by these weapons, and they don't really care whether the U.S. taxpayer paid for them or taxpayers in Belgium paid for them. That's irrelevant to Russian political concerns. But the Trump administration obviously does not have a coherent policy. There is no agreement within the administration. Trump's envoy or babysitter for the Kiev regime, Kellogg, who is certainly right up there in the levels of delusion and disconnection from reality with his pal Zelensky. He openly disagrees, for instance, about ceasefires with what Trump has previously said. But then again, Trump changes his mind every 15 minutes anyway. So right now, that appears to largely be the Trump policy and to express his displeasure that Putin has let him down by not agreeing to end the conflict on American terms, I guess. But what happens 15 minutes from now? No one has any, you know.
I would posit the following, George. If there is a strategy, the strategy is Trump doesn't want to be held responsible for whatever outcome. That's his ultimate goal here.
Unless it's a win.
Well, that we could discuss in the second part of the program about Doha, about wins and losing in foreign policy. But George, that's essentially it. I mean, he's just going to keep hedging his bets, you know, throw crumbs there, give a word of support on the other side, and just kind of shuffle through all of this. And because he's going to say, it's not my war. It was Biden's war. It never would have started if I was president. We know the mantra. I think that's there's no strategic goal. There is a political goal.
I think that's right. I think he is just simply kicking the can down the road and hoping that somehow the final decision will be taken out of his hands, and he'll say, okay, well, you know, I did what I could, and but you know, it really wasn't my war. It was Biden's war, and incidentally, he said the other day also, and Zelensky's war. So he actually blamed Zelensky for it. And I think he really doesn't care very much about this. He at no point has he spelled out how he envisages the final outcome, because essentially any outcome is good for him. He's satisfied with any outcome at all, as long as he can be held to be the man who brought peace. So if it's complete victory for Russia, you know, he's not dissatisfied. If Russia's defeated, he's not dissatisfied. Because he has never spelled out how he would envisage, because the Europeans, essentially, their diplomatic position is Ukraine within its 1991 borders. Trump certainly hasn't said anything of the sort. So he really doesn't care very much. He just wants this off his plate, and he wants the Europeans to stop nagging him about it at every opportunity. Because it's really, you know, Mark, very tiresome.
You know, Mark, the Finnish President Stubb has come out and said that the EU does not intend to take Russia's interests into account when developing European security guarantees for Kyiv. This is really the crux of this entire project here, is the denial or lack of recognition of Russia's security interests. That's the core of this conflict here. And as long as they continue down that path, there will be no peace in Europe.
Well, it's a ridiculous statement, of course, because Russia is the, you know, 1,000-pound gorilla in the room that they're all trying to pretend doesn't exist, but it does. That's okay. I think that's fair enough. Then Russia shouldn't care at all what the Europeans say when they're determining what the outcome of the conflict in Ukraine and the next regime in Kyiv should be. They should have no say in the matter. I think that's the position that Russia should adopt on this, particularly if the United States, if Trump is doing his best, despite the best interests of the blob, the deep state in the U.S., to abdicate responsibility for the conflict completely. But I have to say that no matter on how this conflict ends, Trump is going to be blamed for it. I mean, there's no question about that. He may try to weave and dodge, and it's not my war, but the Western mainstream media is going to blame him. They will also blame Biden for not doing enough, not fast enough. But ultimately, he will be depicted in Western history as the man who surrendered Ukraine to Vladimir Putin. That will be what is written, and he cannot escape that. And he may not like it, and he may be, you know, doing his best, but I mean, he himself noted this week that 90% of the Western mainstream media coverage, well, it's liberal, and it hates him and is negative of him. So
histories are usually written by liberals. So I think he's baked that in. You know, look at the legacy of Richard Nixon, written by liberals.
That's exactly it.
All right, gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Mark, I want to shift gears. The attack on Gaza City, the continued ethnic cleansing of Gaza continues unabated. And with a very, very clear American foot fingerprints all over it here. It is really quite extraordinary to me how the hesitation on the part of Trump when it comes to foreign policy issues like Ukraine, but there's no hesitation whatsoever on what's going on in Gaza.
Well, I mean, that is in line with the principles that Trump campaigned on, make Israel great again, Israel first foreign policy. The Trump administration is trying to push through right now something that will almost certainly be agreed, an extra $6 billion worth of arms for Israel, including 30 Apache attack helicopters and 3,250 armored infantry vehicles, which the only intention, of course, is the only purpose of that is to finish the ethnic cleansing in its entirety of Gaza. And that is what is obviously happening. And it's perhaps more depressing is that a clear majority of the Israeli population, right? It varies a little bit depending on the exact how technical you're being with the language, but clearly support the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So it's not like Netanyahu faces any domestic political support, at least with the intended goal of the military incursion. And the Trump administration is going to shield Israel from everything. They just cast the lone veto for the upteenth time against the UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It's not going to happen. He's giving them a green light for the ethnic cleansing. They're going to take advantage of it. It's the writing on the wall.
You know, George, the choices that the Trump administration has been making has real consequences, even beyond what many describe as a genocide in Gaza. But we had over the last few days Saudi Arabia and Pakistan signing a security agreement that is almost akin to the fall of the Shah in the region many decades ago. I mean, this is the choices the Trump administration is making is not working out for U.S. interests, I would say. I not that I think those interests are legitimate, but as perceived by many, many administrations here. Saudi Arabia has taken note of what can happen when you're an ally to the United States. Obviously, I'm thinking about the bombing of Doha.
Yes, that's true. But to be fair, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are longstanding U.S. allies, and there's nothing unusual about their signing an agreement. They were incidentally
the transfer of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, but they're still, they're allies. I mean, they've always been allies. Saudi Arabia and Iran, that's a different issue, but Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and they were the instigators of Al-Qaeda. I mean, you know, both created Al-Qaeda. But I think the really difficult issue for the Trump administration is Israel is failing. I mean, even this new campaign in Gaza City is already failing. I mean, they're achieving very little. I mean, this war has now been going on for 2 years, and Israel has not succeeded. Israel has still not succeeded in defeating Hamas. Israel is more isolated in the world than ever. I mean, this is what's going to happen at the United Nations General Assembly this week.
As long as Israel has a faithful ally in the United States, why? I'll throw it to Mark. Why should Netanyahu care one way or another?
He doesn't. And he made that perfectly clear. This in the last week, he made a public announcement to the Israeli people that they should be prepared to accept international isolation, that they should pursue a policy of autarky, which is economic self-sufficiency to an extreme degree. But he doesn't have that to fear from the United States. And if he doesn't fear it from the United States, then he doesn't fear it at all. And with regards to the Saudi-Pakistani military alliance, which has a mutual defense clause, right? Which means if Pakistan goes to war with India again, like they just did briefly, then one would assume that Saudi Arabia would then be at war with India. I'm not actually so sure that it's actually going to work that way. But despite the fact that both countries are U.S. partners in the region, the U.S. is not going to be happy about this because they demand a hub and spoke relationship between all of their allies. All of their allies turn to them. They don't have relations with each other, of which the United States is a part, because that means that with security guarantees from Pakistan, Saudi Arabia is less dependent on security guarantees from the United States. And I don't think it's a coincidence, the timing of this announcement right after the U.S. facilitated the Israeli bombing of the U.S. partner of Qatar, supposedly going after Hamas, but evidently mostly killing Qatari citizens, security personnel in the process. So I think this is the potential for the beginnings of geopolitical earthquakes in the Middle East, because if Pakistan and Saudi are signing agreement, other people are going to be looking to hedge their bets against that by signing their own military partnerships.
Yeah, but on the other side, George, and now we're something. I'm thinking about things now that I think I would have thought 2 years ago was simply impossible. But given the posture that Israel has taken in the region, Turkey and Egypt should be very careful. Also, and I'd like to pose this to Mark after you answer. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that Israel would want to see regime change in some of these Gulf countries. They have the capacity to do it. And if the United States, and if it's in the furtherance of Israel's interests, why would the U.S. stop it? Go ahead, George.
No, it wouldn't. There was, in fact, a time not so long ago that Israel actually wanted regime change in Jordan, its great ally in the Middle East, because they said, well, as long as we have the Hashemites in power in Amman, we can't get a Palestinian state actually in Amman. So let's get rid of King Hussein. And that was a clearly Israeli plan. I mean, the United States had to step in and bring that to an end because, you know, Jordan is supposed to be this great U.S. and before that, British ally. No, I think that it's right that Israel is really unrestrained and is clearly, by attacking Doha at a time when the Hamas leaders were there discussing Trump's own peace plan, and doing that would clearly indicate, well, why wouldn't they attack Cairo? And, you know, if there are Hamas leaders in Cairo, why wouldn't they attack anywhere else? So without question, they absolutely Israel could do this. But it's still a question of whether, I mean, when Netanyahu talked about this autarky and that we basically are just going to be running this on an autarkic state. First, I'm not at all sure the Israeli public was particularly enthused by this. And that's why I think Netanyahu started walking back what he said, because really this you know, went down like a, you know, like a lead balloon inside.
Yeah, yeah, but George,
in a way, is going to be a problem. If any country that is hated that much, you have to then wonder how long can you go on existing if you're hated by everybody. South Africa, we thought South Africa would survive forever, hated by everyone, but in fact they caved because they said that we just can't stand being hated by everyone. Israel is now
there's a difference
hated
here
by everyone. Yeah.
But Mark, then Israel essentially becomes the, some people already say it's the 51st state or maybe the first state, and I think that's the magic bullet for Netanyahu. We just become part of the United States. I mean, he acts that way, and American Zionists behave that way. Not that much changes.
Yeah, I was just going to bring up exactly this point. In the last week, there was a meeting of U.S. Congresspeople, House and Senate, in Israel for a conference that the billing was 50 states, one Israel. That was literally the branding for the conference, right? They have such full-throated American political support. Nothing else is needed for them because no one else in the world has the geopolitical and military ability and political will to stop Israel. The Arab countries aren't going to do anything.
Well, I mean, I gave a very long, convoluted question to George. Now I'll kind of separate it out. Then what's to stop Israel from regime change of any country in the region? I mean, the logic of what happened as a result, the logic of what happened to Doha is not missed by anyone. I mean, everyone is a target now.
Yeah, because I'm going to disagree with you because Israel is not capable of regime change of any country.
No. I mean, with American or implicit, explicit support. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If they have U.S. support, okay, you know, something on the level of the Iraq invasion, that's another story. Israel is very good at doing damage to the surrounding countries. And Mossad is excellent at decapitation strikes. They've done them. Hamas, Hezbollah, Yemen, attempted at Iran. But that doesn't change.
Yeah, but that's my point. If you look at these Gulf, let me go to George, these Gulf monarchies are family. So you take out the family. I mean, it's not like destroying the state. I mean, what you do is a target. They're very good at it, as Mark said. You target, take out the family. That's regime change.
Well, they could, but you'd have to then ask, would regime change serve Israel's interests? Maybe. I mean, at the moment, the setup isn't so bad for Israel, because after all, since October the 7th, not one of these Arab states has broken off diplomatic relations with Israel, and not one has taken any severe measures against Israel. So there's no real necessity for Israel to act against any of these Arab states. I mean, they might think, Saudi Arabia, it's too close to the United States. They're getting all sorts of favors from Washington, but that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, America is so wholeheartedly on behalf of Israel, it doesn't really even pay attention any longer to keeping Riyadh happy. So in principle, yes, Israel could attempt regime change, but there's no.
I'll end on this, maybe because of the threat, the potential threat is enough to paralyze the entire region into acting or working together. On that very depressing note, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests here in Budapest and in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RTC. And next time, remember, Crosstalk rules.